Hi there. You're listening to So What, a podcast from Canadian Mennonite University. CMU is in Treaty 1 territory, Winnipeg, Manitoba. I'm your host, Jonas Cornelson, coming to you from Treaty 7, Calgary, Alberta. And I'm not the only voice you'll hear out of Treaty 7 today. Our featured CMU lecture in this episode is by Dr. Allison Menzies from the University of Calgary. Now, just in case the Winnipeg, Calgary of it all is giving you whiplash, or if you're new to the podcast, let me back up a bit. So What is a show where I take recorded public events from CMU, find some of the key storylines, and riff on how they may apply to life beyond university. I flatter myself as being qualified to do this, having graduated from CMU back in 2016, later moving to Calgary, dropping out of grad school at U of C, and living a relatively less academic life since then, sometimes wondering desperately if the stuff I learned in academia matters at all. That angst is largely what keeps me making this podcast, wanting the education I spent a lot of time, money, and brain cells on to stay relevant. So that's me. As I said earlier, this episode's CMU event features someone who has found much more success at the University of Calgary than I did. Dr. Allison Menzies is an assistant professor in biological sciences at U of C, researching wildlife conservation. Allie, as she was introduced for her public lecture, visited CMU as the 2024 Scientist in Residence. It was a homecoming of sorts, with her having grown up in Western Manitoba. The lecture itself was titled Honoring the Past, Safeguarding the Future, Prioritizing Indigenous Knowledge in Wildlife Conservation. As you'll hear very soon, it's about wildlife, but even more so how we as humans understand our fellow animal species and whose values are reflected in that process. I decided to pull this one out for the June episode because it's a time of year where I'm outside a lot more, and I imagine you might be too, and this conversation gives us lots to reflect on when enjoying the great outdoors. So let's get to it. Here's Allie introducing herself, personally and professionally, and hinting at some of the themes that we'll pull out as we go.
As for myself as a person, I am also a daughter and a sister and a cousin and an auntie and a friend and a community member, and I'm also a wildlife biologist. And my first research job was working on bats here in Manitoba, also pursuing my master's on the same topic, eventually going to McGill. As was stated, I got to work on Canada lynx and snowshoe hares in the Yukon, where I got the opportunity to spend a lot of time in the boreal forest in the winter, snowshoeing around. And through all of this work, I've really had what I consider an extreme privilege to spend a lot of time outside, a lot of time interacting with wildlife and species in ways that most people don't. And this has been really formative in changing kind of my identity and my values and how I relate to the world. While I thought my PhD would mostly be about animals and how they live and how they exist, I learned a lot more about my own purpose and my place in this interconnected web of all living beings. And I also grew as someone who now proudly identifies as a Métis scientist and a Métis woman, and someone who really has a platform in which to bridge together both my natural science knowledge and understanding and some of the ancestral teachings and knowledge that has been excluded from the world of conservation for a very long time.
Two things I want you to keep in mind there, besides Allie being an awesome person who does cool stuff. One, doing science differently, specifically bringing Indigenous knowledge and wisdom into conversation with the comparatively dry academic natural sciences. Two, it's about us. The more we learn about the, quote, natural world, the more we learn about our place in it, and that we fundamentally belong to nature rather than existing somehow outside of it, observing rather than participating. Both of these themes really touch on that observing-participating dynamic. So let's start talking about doing science differently, what I'll call theme one, by hearing Allie talk about the limitations of science as we commonly know it now.
Since the development of the Western world and the subsequent colonization of much of the globe, the majority of policies, laws, customs, and behaviors are built off of a Western worldview, or in this case, Western science. And this worldview tends to see humans at the top of a hierarchy or a pyramid, or all forms of life, suggesting a more hierarchical relationship among living beings. And this leads to a perception, often, that the land is a set of resources or something that is available for development or extraction for human benefit. And this can be seen in a lot of the language that's commonly used. Things like the term wildlife management implies humans have control over or can manage wildlife. Or the department I did my PhD in, natural resource sciences, implying that nature is a resource to be extracted. Or even the concept of ecosystem services, suggesting that services that the land provides humans.
That is super interesting. I love considering how the language we use affects our thinking and relationships. Essentially, natural resources makes the land, water, plants, animals, etc. into objects that we not only observe, as in science, but use to our exclusive benefit. There's no give and take, we just, well, take. Side note, have you ever thought about the term human resources and what that implies about you as a worker? That was pointed out to me in a CMU sociology class with Rod Rayner, and I've never been able to shake it. Anyway, Ali sees this objectifying language and the science it underpins as a problem. Here's a bit about what she wants to do about it.
And so the basis of the work that I've been doing for the last 2 years is that achieving more effective and equitable conservation practices and policies involves shifting from this human-centric or top-down perspective of environmental conservation to a more holistic or interconnected perspective that considers all living beings as equal or equally worthy of respect and care. So as dominant Western approaches fall short, and I think we can agree that they are at this moment, a lot of what my work focused on was trying to figure out how we shift the way that we relate to the environment and think about the environment.
It will be no surprise to you if you've listened to other episodes of this show, say on treaty, reconciliation, etc., that this interconnected way of understanding is more closely aligned with different indigenous cultures across Turtle Island and elsewhere. Ali is careful to point out, as I will now too, that we're not talking about individual people, but cultures, institutions, and practices that evolved over thousands of years in different places, and have had an uneasy relationship, to say the very least, since coming into contact. And while this should have been done much sooner, the sense that I get from Ali's presentation is, given the ecological challenges we're facing, it is more important than ever to bring that deep, interconnected understanding of this land that Indigenous peoples have cultivated into conversation with the kind of science more often practiced by Canadian governments and universities. All that being said, how do we actually do it? One project that Ali has done significant work on, observing moose with Magnetowan First Nation in Ontario, demonstrates what she is talking about, including our personal connections to the species we observe, and where government and academic priorities align well with those of Indigenous communities.
So a lot of the work that I've done over the past few years has focused on moose. And so I'm going to use moose as a bit of a case study today for some of the themes and lessons that I'm talking about. And growing up in Manitoba, moose have always been part of my relationship to the natural world. They're an iconic and important species. My dad hunted moose for a long time. We ate moose. My brother now hunts as well. And I think every person in the audience can think of a species or a place that over their lifetime has changed a lot. And for me, it's been not seeing moose as often as I normally would, driving through Riding Mountain National Park or driving along the highway, not eating moose anymore. My dad can't hunt moose anymore often. There's not tags for them. And so as I've grown into an applied wildlife biologist, especially one that works closely with Indigenous communities, these are the problems that I'm forced to think about and try to solve on a daily basis. And they're big and they're overwhelming and they impact people's livelihoods and nutrition and food security. Really, it's about how do we ensure that the species that we love and that are important to us remain healthy, accessible, and part of our everyday lives. The answer to a lot of these questions aren't actually about the animals at all. As this quote states, the way to resolve the moose concerns, of course, is not biology, but it's about people.
I must admit here, growing up in Manitoba as well, but very much in the city, my main connection to moose in my youth was going to watch the Manitoba Moose hockey team. I'm super glad they came back, but the outdoor moose, as it were, have had it tougher. I'm going to give Allie the floor for an extended period of time here, telling the story of that moose project I mentioned before. She explains everything so clearly, I feel no need to interject. As you listen, keep in mind what she just said about looking for solutions among people as much as among the animals themselves. Allie, take it away.
I wanted to share a case study of how we've been trying to put these values into practice in the context of community-based monitoring with Magnetowan First Nation in Ontario. And this focused on moose, and there are three main reasons why we focused on moose for this case study. The first is that moose are important. As I shared earlier, moose are an iconic species here. They're an iconic species, you know, in my family, in the prairies, for many people. For non-Indigenous folks, moose are valued for food, for recreation, for connection to nature, possibly for tourism. And for many Indigenous nations, they're considered a culturally significant or cultural keystone species. They are critical for food, for social relationships, for opportunities to share knowledge, for teaching youth important teachings, for art, for ceremony, for even for identity. And so moose are important to a lot of people, meaning they're a species that presumably we should all want to care for and we should all want the best for. So we thought this was a good place to start enacting more collaborative and respectful cross-cultural work on a species. Second, moose are declining in most of their, most of where they are in Canada, they are in decline. Both Western scientific data and Indigenous knowledge point to alarming declines in this region of the country. They're linked to things like predation, car accidents, climate change, parasites, like everything. And while it's generally understood that many of these things affect moose, what affects them in one place versus another is really not as well understood. So what's impacting moose in northern Manitoba may not be the same as what's impacting moose in southern BC. They're just different environments, different pressures, different species. And so regardless of why declines are happening, which is one of the questions we're interested in, the declines are concerning and pose threats to food security for Indigenous people, culture, but also for non-Indigenous people as well. And I think although it is concerning right now, there's a general lack of collaborative work on moose. So that's the third reason why we chose this as a case study. There are a lot of limitations and challenges with the way that moose are currently monitored and managed in the province, mostly resulting from a lack of information to make decisions from. And the methods and approaches currently do not really involve Indigenous people. And so one approach in science, kind of widespread, that's becoming more popular, the alternative to more top-down, government-driven monitoring, is wildlife monitoring called community-based monitoring. And as the name suggests, it's just simply monitoring wildlife in a way that directly incorporates local community members and is defined or driven by the needs and interests of the community. It's similar to citizen science, if you've heard of citizen science, but that is normally driven completely by scientists, with members of the public gathering information and giving it back to the scientists. Community-based monitoring is more kind of driven and rooted in the interests of the community. And there are plenty of examples of community-based monitoring programs around the globe, and especially more interesting Indigenous-led community-based monitoring programs because of the approach that underlies these programs and the link to increasing Indigenous self-determination in science. So fundamentally, this approach can gather information on moose at a local scale, if that is the interest or the desire of the community. in this case, Moose. Because it is community-driven or community-based, this often occurs at a local scale. In our case, it was at the scale of a traditional territory of a First Nation. But what makes this approach so powerful in this context is the fact that it's driven by the needs and the goals of the community or all the partners involved, which means it can be a lot more than just about the data. And in this case, it was about highlighting community priorities, centering community-specific values that I talked about before. It is flexible in the methods that you use, so can incorporate both Western science and Indigenous knowledge. And again, it supports Indigenous self-determination in science, and that was another one of our prime goals of this project. They wanted to know three fairly basic things. They wanted to know where moose are, how many are there, and are they healthy? And when I say basic, it's not that easy to figure this out. It's just these are the fundamental questions that any wildlife monitoring program wants to know, including the government ones. Where are these animals, how many are there, and are they healthy? So already that was a good sign that the data that the community was interested in is also the data that the government's interested in, which again creates opportunity for collaboration. And in addition, the community had three specific priorities that they wanted. The first, they wanted to use non-invasive methods. So a lot of large mammal projects use collars, which are a bit more invasive, and they didn't want that. They wanted a non-invasive method. They wanted to center their own knowledge, and they wanted to respect Anishinaabe traditions and values in the process. So the next step was trying to figure out a tool or approach that would work well within this context. We didn't have the funding or the capacity to do aerial surveys. We didn't want to use collars because it's too intense and too invasive for the species. And this is another important component of building this program and as scientists thinking about the tools that we use is method development, trying to figure out, we want this information, how do we get there in a way that we trust and that we believe in? And that is comparable to other tools being used. And what we settled on was using trail cameras or motion-sensored wildlife cameras. So essentially, they'll take a photo or a video anytime something walks or moves in front of them. Often it's animals, sometimes people. A lot of the time, unfortunately, it's just grass blowing in the wind. They're essentially an extra set of eyes in the forest. And we use them because they have been shown to provide the information that we need. They've been used for wildlife monitoring to look at abundance, so how many are there, space use, where are they, and other indicators of population health. But they also have long-term monitoring potential. And so when working with the community, one of the things we were interested in was we don't want to just go in, do this, leave, and have the monitoring program fall apart. And so once you set up the wildlife cameras, they can stay there as long as you need, as long as they have batteries. And so it could be a multi-year or multi-decade monitoring program after we help set them up. But the points I wanted to emphasize was that the trail cameras had many qualities that made them great for prioritizing community values. Namely, they are a non-invasive method. And to a lot of elders, they said, this is a sign of respect. We're respecting the animals, we're not interfering with them, and we're gathering knowledge or information from them without disrupting their lives. They're affordable and accessible. And by accessible, I mean they take photos. And that's something that almost everyone can relate to, can understand. It's not some complex data file that you get. It's literally a folder of photos. They can be set up across the entire territory, and that was another thing the community wanted was we want to know what's going on across our territory. Some places are harder to get to than others, but once you put a camera there, it can take photos. And again, with the pictures, it had really good outreach and education potential, and they really wanted a way to engage youth in wildlife monitoring conservation. So everyone loves fun photos of wildlife. It's really easy to go into schools and to show the youth and the kids and get them to help ID wildlife or show them what's around them when they're not there. So in terms of answering how many moose are there and where are they on the landscape, we started calculating a simple metric of moose activity just by counting the number of pictures of moose at each activity. And this is called a relative abundance index.
Okay. Sorry, I said I wouldn't cut in, but the visual that you can't see right now is really key here. As Allie is describing this index, there's a picture on the screen behind her, essentially showing the outline of Magnetawan First Nation, just over 47 square kilometers, with a grid of circles roughly 4 tall and 8 wide representing where each trail camera was. Okay, now that you have that picture in your mind, here's Allie describing what that index showed.
It's not necessarily meaning that if we counted 10 photos, that means there's 10 moose there. But what it does mean is if there's 10 photos here and 0 here, there's likely more moose here than there are here. So it's just a relative index of activity or abundance. So what this map is showing is the territory of Magnetawan First Nation. And each of the circles is where we put a trail camera. If the circle is small and blank, that means there were no photos of moose. If it's small and black, that means there was a few photos of moose. And if it's big and black, that means there were a lot of photos of moose. And this was kind of the first product that the students produced for the community, just to show this is something we found, and this is kind of the image of what we're finding in your territory. And this was really interesting to the community. It already, in and of itself, you can start seeing some patterns or some unique things. People started asking questions.
Another key visual element. There's one black circle on the map, pretty close to the middle, that's much bigger than all the others.
We showed this map to one of the elders in the community, and he immediately was like, oh yeah, that's where the moose nap in the long grass. And immediately knew that this big circle where we had almost 10 times the photos as we did anywhere else, he said, there's always a moose there. And so it started these conversations about what are the moose doing on the territory? Here's what this Western science tool can show. And then here's how you can contextualize it, and here's what you know. And it came to the same conclusion and then added a lot of context to what we were finding. And so it started a lot of these conversations with community members about what they know, about what we could show them the tool showed, and then it really brought a lot of that together and just started opportunities for storytelling.
I just love that outcome with the one big dot. It borders on a well, duh type of moment, or I could have told you that. But given the relationships that Allie and her research team worked so hard to build with the local community, it sounds like the overall tone was much more joyful at finding this great connection. That's where I'm going to leave the moose story, and soon I'm going to try to wrap up the episode, but I feel we've gotten to the point in the show where we have to ask, so what? Does doing science differently matter to me if I don't usually consider myself one who does science at all? What about the other theme we talked about? That all this is really about people and our relationship to/with nature. How do I cultivate that if I live in a basement apartment in the city? Not just a rhetorical question, I do. I'm going to give my best shot at the doing science differently question before I bring Allie back. Okay, so for one thing, you, yes you, can do science even if you're not a professional scientist. Shortly before I started working on this episode, I got an email inviting me to a nearby creek that a group of Calgarians is trying to protect from industrial development and document plants, animals, etc. using the iNaturalist app as part of a Canada-wide wildlife counting event. I didn't go, but I could have, and unfortunately that's as good a point as I can make right now. There are opportunities to get involved. Don't be like me and just think about it. Go for it. Also, you, yes, still you, can invite your governments and other institutions to do science differently and incorporate more community-based approaches in how they monitor wildlife. Right now in Manitoba, per Allie's presentation, moose are monitored through aerial surveys in maybe 3 sample locations a year. If every First Nation in the province could set up a program like Allie described, the data would be much more reliable, far more useful at a local scale, and it would probably be more cost-effective. So write to your provincial representative. Give them something to think about. So that's doing science differently. You can do it, and you can also tell other people to do it. And finally, theme 2. It's about us. Remember this clip from earlier?
The answer to a lot of these questions aren't actually about the animals at all. As this quote states, the way to resolve the moose concerns, of course, is not biology, but it's about people.
So with that in mind, what does it actually look like for us to shift our understanding of nature from something we observe and use to something that we're a part of? Another research project that Allie has worked on took a broader look at the values First Nations peoples in Canada applied to their own practices of wildlife conservation. And the ones I want to leave you with that work just as well in the city as in the wilderness are gratitude, responsibility, and moderation. Here's Allie.
Others talked about the importance of expressing gratitude for all the gifts that the land provides, and not only just generally acknowledging it, but even expressing it. Participants talked about saying the words thank you when harvesting or when out for a walk or when just feeling the beauty of the natural world. And I would just encourage you, you know, the next moment you're outside and you just think something amazing is happening, to just say thank you. It's a small act, but I think it just expresses some of these values that we often forget to express. Many participants talked about a deep responsibility to creation, and responsibility is another value or teaching that I've heard a lot in this context, that the land gives us so much that we have a responsibility to look after it. But the other way that folks talked about it was a responsibility to future generations, that we have a responsibility to care for what we interact with so that it's here for our children or our grandchildren. And one of my favorite teachings or quotes that someone shared is, we do not inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. And I think that really kind of shifted a little bit of how I thought about it, is you're borrowing this from future generations, it's not yours to gift to anyone. Most spoke of the need for moderation, and this one was pretty straightforward, only take what you need. Folks shared a lot of examples of harvesting practices where you harvest bark in a way that won't kill the tree so that it can keep regenerating. You don't take the first thing you see in case it's the last one. Things like that, about just only taking what you need and taking enough that won't harm the species or the animal.
Okay, I said these things worked in cities. Maybe not to be taken literally. You're maybe not harvesting bark or hunting animals on Main Street. But aren't all of the things that we see and touch in cities, food at the grocery store, concrete that made roads and buildings, even gas for cars, aren't they ultimately from the land somewhere? What would it look like to say thank you at the grocery store? Or to only take what we really need at the gas station? Does this mean I should drive out of the city less to, well, connect with nature? That makes me kind of uncomfortable. And some of those trips are still important. Maybe we need to consider how far we go and how frequently, or if we could have, say, buses or trains. But it's certainly not all or nothing. Of course, many of us in Canada are lucky to live in cities that allow for some access to trees, rivers, etc. right here. Calgary, despite or maybe because of its urban sprawl, has an embarrassment of riches in terms of large naturalistic city parks. And if you find yourself ever near CMU's campus in Winnipeg, go for a walk in the Assiniboine Forest right next door. I'm rambling now, and maybe I haven't tied up everything neatly, but that really is where I wanted to leave you for this June episode, with the encouragement to go outside and find ways to practice that gratitude, responsibility, and moderation. To close out, I'd like to extend my deepest thanks to Dr. Allison Menzies, Allie, for her inspiring lecture and work. Thanks also to CMU for giving me a venue to dive into it, and as always, thanks to you for listening. We do this podcast quarterly, so I'll talk to you again in 3 months. My name is Jonas Cornelson. Have a great summer, and I'll see you in September.